Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB, and Paul, WS2N. Those three guys try to run this thing. They try to be the net control operators for the thing called the Technical Net, which meets almost every single Sunday night for the last 30 years, would you believe? This is TechNet number 1,451 of the series that began way back in September of 1982, 30 and a half or so years ago. For all of that time, what these guys do is they gather on Sunday nights and teach each other ham radio stuff. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. What you're listening to right now is a 2-meter FM repeater type ham radio. And if that doesn't please you, before you give up this very educational hobby, try one of the other 25 kinds. I realized something funny this week, and that is that I've always been saying, let me drop it. I've been saying that inside of every ham radio operator is this kind of a scientist that wants to get out. That's part of the explanation I'm slowly coming up with as to why this TechNet has lasted so long. We know there's a real thirst for knowledge, ham radio type knowledge out there. And that thirst seems like it can only be answered by people finding out how to make better use of their antennas and transmission lines and propagation and the various modes and so on. Transmitters, receivers, they want to understand all this stuff. Well, just like there's many kinds of ham radio, 26 kinds of ham radio, there's many kinds of ham. One of the prominent hams I met this week was proud of the fact that he's an appliance operator. And I asked him a little bit more about that. Appliance operator means that he doesn't care what's inside the radio. It's a tool. It's a tool by which he can communicate. His automobile is a tool. And if the tool doesn't work correctly, he brings it to a person that fixes the tool. And so it's a means to an end, not an end in itself. That's another kind of ham radio operator. And we don't want to discriminate against those guys. They're real people, too. Just like in the early days of, 20-some-odd years ago, people used to say very disparaging remarks about citizens band operators. It turns out an awful lot of people cut their teeth radio-wise on citizens band, eventually found out there's something called ham radio, and they found out, gee, that's a much better way to go. You get a lot more frequencies, you can run more power, you talk to more interesting people, and they flipped over. So to discriminate against a ham radio operator just because he used to be a CB-er is not fair. Discriminate against a ham radio operator because you don't like his color, his religion, his ethnicity. That's not fair. Any kind of discrimination doesn't work. And discrimination against a guy who is not a real ham, as we used to say, just because he's an appliance operator, that's perfectly valid also. When it comes to emergency communication, that appliance operator could be a very valuable man. So, once again, I guess that we got to not discriminate. I'm one of those people who has to listen to that message from time to time. Let me drop it. We're also going to find out tonight if anybody's left on Long Island. Did you guys all go away for the so-called Memorial Day weekend? Is anybody left to talk to the TechNet? We'll soon find that out. One of the people who checked in last week who didn't get a chance to ask his question for a whole bunch of reasons was West, WS2N, so he's going to go high on the list tonight. We're going to make him the second person. West is into X-ray and has already checked in. A person checks into the Technical Net by giving Paul, John, and Dick, give the three operators your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not check in just because you're listening. After 30 years, we believe somebody is listening. It doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. We save some time by not having a long list of people just signing in saying, I'm here. Okay, as I said, a person's going to give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes. A typical sign-in would sound like this, WA2PJF, veto, and yes. So give me your call letters and name right now, K2RAW.
WSLW, John, and yes.
Yes.
Okay, that was a kind of a double. I heard something, John, and yes. First, John, what was your call letters?
Yes.
And to SLW, John, and yes.
Five.
Okay, we got John and to SLW. Who is the second person checking in?
No, you answer all I want. Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Joe. So far we got John and Joe. Who else is checking in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
This is KC2, Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe. This is Joe number 2, and yes.
Very fine. We got Joe number 2. So we got John, Joe number 1, Joe number 2. Wes, who else is checking in? Give me a call at
repeater. Time out.
Whiskey Kilo, Whiskey and Charlie, Sugar X-Ray, my Bronx, New York. Name is Mark.
WS2N, with the space report. Good evening, John. Good evening, Dick.
Oh, we got you, Paul.
Good something.
Very fine, we got you, Paul. Mark in Bronx. Give me your call letters again, Mark. Mark in the Bronx, please give me your call letters. The person who checked in from the Bronx, please give me your call letters. Okay, did anybody else hear his call letters? It happened kind of fast and I missed it. John, did you catch his call letters?
Hey, Dick, how you doing? I was on HT. I was coming to the shack here. This is K2CSX from the Bronx. Name is Mark, and good evening to everybody, and happy Memorial Day. K2CSX.
Okay, is that Kilo Charlie 2, Charlie Fox X-Ray? Is that your call letters, Mark?
Negative. Kilowatt number 2, Charlie Sugar X-Ray. CSX like the railroad. K2CSX.
Very fine. Charlie Sierra X-Ray. Over the air, that's a bit of a tongue twister, and not many people are going to hear those letters all by themselves and catch whether or not it's Charlie Sierra X-Ray, Charlie Foxtrot X-Ray, and so on. Okay. Anybody else checking? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Whiskey Kilo, 3 Singo, Mike.
Okay, your modulation is extremely heavy, Mike. I heard Whiskey 2 something. Give me the rest of it, Mike.
Yeah, sorry about that. Whiskey Kilowatt 3 Tango. Name's Mike.
Okay, I think I got Whiskey Kilowatt 3 Tango. Is that true, Mike?
Yeah, that is correct.
Very fine. All right, we got more than enough to get going. John number 1. Whiskey 2. Sierra Whiskey. Lima Whiskey. Go right ahead, John.
Okay, Dick, it's November 2, Sierra Lima Whiskey, John and Queen.
Go right ahead, John and Queen.
Okay, Net, in the April 2013 issue of QSB was an article titled, Build a Tower or Shaggy Antenna. And since it didn't have altitude in the title, Dick didn't see it. I read the article and was been playing around. The gentleman built a beam, which he mounted on the ground, a three-element Yagi with three pieces per each element, one a vertical and two collinear elements, and he's getting fantastic reports from it and with it, and using it mounted about 12 foot off the ground. Well, he's made it 20-meter one, so it's 36 feet long. Let me let it drop.
And by the way, I'm looking at the April issue, so please tell me what page that's on.
Okay, Dick, it's page 34. Anyway, gentlemen and ladies, not having enough room and being rather frugal, I used three hamsticks on 20 meters and made a single element with three pieces for the element, for the driven element. And it listens very well. I've been south of Barcelona. I've been to the Canary Islands. It's heard Kuwait City, Slovenia, Manchester, England, France. Almost every state in the Union. Well, I haven't made a lot of contacts because I can't match it very well with the tuner I have applied to my radio. Dick wasn't familiar with the article the other day when he heard about it, And my question to Dick is, did he read the article? Does he have an opinion? Over to you.
Yeah, John, you and I had a little bit of a discussion about this a couple of days ago. And by the way, it's called the Garden Game. You called it tonight a towerless Yagi. And I was looking on the index list for the towerless Yagi, couldn't find it. So you used a different title, and you confused me. But when you told me page 34, I know what you're talking about. Okay, that's a rather nice Yagi-like antenna. And the fact that it receives well, and the fact that you can aim it, I'm guessing you can aim it and you see the signals peak up and go down as you rotate it. I'm assuming you've got a rotator. And yes, your particular transmitter, your particular antenna tuner, automatic antenna tuner, keeps giving you an answer no matter what you do, that the VisWire is beyond its range. And because the data sheet on your particular antenna tuner, the automatic antenna tuner, says it's not guaranteed to work beyond 3-1. And no matter what combination you use, no matter how you connect the transmission line to your three ham sticks, you keep getting that trip out, so to speak, of the antenna tuner. Therefore, you've assumed it's above 3-1 standing wave ratio. Let me drop. And so, without a real standing wave ratio measurement of all of the combinations you've made on changing the way you feed it in the physical arrangements and so on, parallel series and tilting them at various angles, with all those changes, because you kept getting an answer, no solution, so to speak, you had no information. You know that something's not right, but that you don't know whether you're going in the right direction. I mean, some of those tilts you did maybe brought the VisWire down half of what it used to be, and that would tell you right away you're going in the right direction. So by borrowing somebody else's rig, by using the antenna tuner in the bypass mode so that the transmitter is now going straight to the antenna, by borrowing somebody's standing wave ratio meter, one way or another, there's got to be a way, even if you're running at the 1-watt level where it doesn't trip out, there's got to be a way where you can put power on your favorite frequency, 2 meters or 440 or 20 meters, whatever it is, into this antenna. I'm going to guess it's 20 meters. And with a VisWire measurement, it's like a blind man walking up a hill. You'll know when you're going in the right direction. But you start off, you got to start off with a real piece of data. The confusing factor here is, let me drop. Sometimes there's RF in the shack, which confuses the daylight out of a antenna tuner. Sometimes an antenna tuner has got one little magic spot somewhere on the Smith chart, some particular impedance, where it can't find a solution. So the fact that your antenna tuner is not finding a solution is a piece of information, but it's vague. It's not quantitative. All we know is it ain't working. Well, you got to tell, I mean, if you brought your automobile to a automobile dealer and said, please fix your car, and he says, what's your complaint? And you're saying, and you tell him, it ain't working. And he's going to say, you got to be a little bit more specific than that. You got to give me a hint. And so that's sort of what's going on here. So my recommendation, John, number one, is that you find some way of getting a real standing wave ratio measurement. Is it 2-1? Is it 20-1? I mean, is it rape or murder, if you know what I mean? There's a big difference between the two. So 2-1 or 20-1. All we know is it's high enough for your particular antenna tuner that it doesn't find a solution. There's multiple cases of where a guy had an antenna tuner that wouldn't find a solution. In some cases, all he had to do is put a random length of cable, an extra piece of cable, on the transmission line after the tuner. And all that does is that it takes whatever reflective power you're getting from your antenna, that's what's creating the VisWire, some reflective power, by adding that extra length of cable, you're taking the reflective power from the transmitter, from the antenna, and giving it some extra phase shift. That's what the extra length of cable does. And in many cases, that extra phase shift takes your, it doesn't make your standing wave ratio go bigger or smaller. It just changes the phase angle. And all of a sudden, the antenna tuner says, hey, I'm happy with that phase angle. And it finds a solution. So you got to make, as I see it, John, right now, all we know is it ain't working. And you've done the right things as far as I'm concerned. And so there's some of a funny mystery going on here. Your antenna tuner, for some reason we haven't yet found out, is unhappy. It's going to take a further measurement. So with all the friends you got here on Limark, 380 some odd numbers, some one of them is going to loan you a rig A standing wave ratio meter. Come to your house and make a measurement. We've got to find out what is the real VISWR for where you are right now, and will a random length of cable or something you can try, will it make an improvement? So right now, although you've made a lot of experiments, John, we have more unknowns than knowns, and therefore there's no simple solution to this one yet. We're going to have to send you back and do a little bit more homework for us, John, to find out exactly how bad is that VISWR. KC2, here we go. N2, SLW, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, thank you very much. I will definitely make some more substitutions and do some more definitive tests in the near future, and I promise to come back to the net with results. I wanted to bring it to the net's attention because since the antenna doesn't exhibit straight up skywave incident, or whatever that abbreviation is, I don't remember it right now, and it is, seems to be receding over a wide angle, it may be very, very useful. And there might be a lot of guys out there with two ham sticks on the same band, and all they have to do is get a third one and make some kind of a bracket to mount the three of them, one vertical, two horizontal. It wouldn't be an expensive change. And it's been mounted at 12 feet off the ground on a tripod, and the radio was on battery. So if anybody hasn't seen the article and wants to look at it, April QST, and wish you a lot of luck. Thank you very much, Dick.
Yeah, that abbreviation you were looking for, John, is NEVIS, Near Vertical Incident Skywave Antenna. And so many antennas, particularly horizontally polarized antennas, when you put them very close to the ground reflection plus the real signal coming out of the antenna gives you a combination where your angle, your vertical angle coming off, your elevation angle of the signal being transmitted can be, 90 degrees straight up in the air. And until you get some good number of wavelengths off the ground with a horizontally polarized antenna, you'll be building a NEVIS antenna. And NEVIS antennas, as long as the ionosphere is supporting it, give you some very nice short-range communication. You want to talk to a guy in New Jersey, and you're on Long Island, a NEVIS antenna can do it for you. One of the things that's hard to believe is that you can be using 10 watts of power on 2 meters. You talk to your buddy in New Jersey, and you're 20 dB over 9 on his S meter. So the two of you on 20 meters, on 2 meters, are talking back and forth. You go over to 20 meters, and you got the exact same altitude on antennas on both ends. You expect to be gangbusters to each other, and you don't hear each other. Lots of people have run into that problem. And what's mysterious about that is that on 2 meters, the amount of background noise of the universe is very weak. And therefore, a few microvolt signal into a good receiver will be almost dead full quieting on 2 meters. However, the background noise of Mother Nature on 20 meters is such that you've got the equivalent of a 20 dB noise figure. It takes a hell of a lot stronger signal to override your receiver noise from the universe, so to speak. On top of that, the much lower frequency, the much bigger wavelength, is giving you a much higher angle of radiation. So on 20 meters, you're shooting a lot of the energy up in the air. That the ionosphere is not responding.
Repeater, time out.
And if the ionosphere is not reflecting it to your buddy in New Jersey, you don't hear each other. So, as you can tell, when you change frequency by a whole lot, crazy things happen. In the case of the 10 gig guys, almost all the guys on 10 gigs in the August and September contest will go on the tuned frequency, on the talkback frequency, 144.260 sideband, and they say, is there anybody out there? And the guy says, yeah, I'm on Mount Equinox. And the other guy says, yeah, I'm on Mount Wachusett. And therefore, we know each other's directions. We aim our antennas each other on 10 gigs. And you transmit first. I'll play it back to you on 2 meters to help you line up the antennas. So they do the lineup on 2 meters, and then they talk on 10 gigs to make the QSO official. You'd be amazed how many times when the 2-meter pass doesn't make it, you can't communicate between mountain A and mountain B on 2 meters, and the guys just give up and go on 10 gigs and give a CQ and they get an answer. So who would think that 10 gigs at times propagates a hell of a lot better than 2 meters? Who would think that 2 meters propagates a hell of a lot better than 20 meters over a short distance? And so now you know some of the reasons why we hams have got a ham band assigned to us, every single octave of the band, every single octave in frequency, another ham band exists, because sometimes the conditions are so different, the antennas are so different, the technology used is so different, and it's all beneficial. Okay, next person we're going to go to is Wes, N2XJN. Now, choose just one subject, Wes, because I know you're pursuing quite a few goals simultaneously. Choose one of them, and let's discuss it. N2XJN, K2RIW, you got it, Wes. One more call, N2XJN, are you there, Wes? K2RIW. Okay, maybe Wes is not there now. We'll get to him later. Joe number two, W2RYY. Go right ahead with you, Joe. And by the way, John, please come back as you make those measurements. You've got quite a mystery there, and we want to hear more about it, because that antenna on page 34 of the April issue looks like a nice antenna. And so it should work, and we'll soon find out what's going on. Joe, W2RYY, what's going on there in your neck of the woods, Joe? K2RIW.
Delta checked it before me.
Of the guys, well, I'm not quite sure. Now, yeah, I missed some people in the beginning. Right now, you're number two in my list. We're going to get everybody. Not to worry, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW, you got it.
Okay. Here's a question for you. I know they make devices that are capable of listening to electronic components, that you can physically touch them. You can hear things making noise. I've heard of these type of things. It resembles like something like a stethoscope type of arrangement. I guess if you see if a part is making noise, or some sort of device within an electronic assembly is making a noise. Do they make the reverse of that, where you're able to actually use something similar to that that's capable of putting a pinpoint type of sound pressure on a component, to modulate that component, to look at the results of that component doing something in an electronic circuit? Back to you, Dick. That'll explain what I'm using it for.
I presume you're talking about acoustic noise now. In other words, we've all seen these so-called injectors. In other words, if I was doing troubleshooting on a radio, and I'm not getting, I connect the antenna to the radio, I listen to the loudspeaker, and no signal is coming through. So the radio consists of, let me pick a number, 8 individual stages, and one of those stages is not passing the signal. So if you've got a signal injector, a radio injector, something that makes broadband radio noise, and sometimes it's in the form of a pen, and you touch it to the volume control, and it makes some audio noise, you know, voltage-wise audio noise, and you hear that coming out of the loudspeaker, and you know that everything from the volume control and all the audio stages downrange out to the loudspeaker, that's working. And then you go back to one IF stage, and you touch this thing, and you hear some noise, and you know that IF stage is working. And you go back another stage, and you slowly work your way all the way back to the front end of the radio, and pretty soon you inject this little thing, and you hear nothing coming out, and you say, aha, somewhere in between those two last measurements, that stage is dead, and now you find out, is the tube dead, is the transistor dead, is it getting voltage, has a capacitor becoming shorted, and so on. So an injector, a radio voltage noise injector, is a very handy thing. Now, in the case of some components that have a failure by way of microphonics, acoustic failure, I think you're asking, does somebody have something that's like a tiny, tiny loudspeaker on the end of a pen that makes acoustic noise, it makes vibration, and you touch a component with that to find out if you get a change in the performance? That's what it sounded like you're saying, but I may have misinterpreted you there, Joe. So give me a few more words. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, when you first started talking about signal tracing, I thought you were going to go down the RF path and go in the RF direction. But the second part is exactly what I'm looking for.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
that are absolutely microphonic in nature, and it's kind of tough to find a specific part on this assembly that I'm trying to work with. And you've seen the assembly itself opened up, so you know what I'm dealing with. I don't have to go into specifics over here, but for the content of the conversation here, that's what the whole scope of this conversation is. It's to try to find a specific part that is microphonic in nature. And it's very tough because when you tap on this particular device in a certain corner of the board, you get microphonic effect. It seems like in several components, it's very hard to narrow it down to one specific component. That's why I'm looking for something that I can put like a pinpoint type of, for lack of a better term, modulating type of sound pressure on this part itself to sort of look for the most change in the observed signal of what you're looking for to say, okay, that's a bad chip cap, that's a bad chip resistor, or that's a bad connection on the board itself. So do you follow what I'm saying now?
Yes, I do. And there's a definite need for that tool that you're now describing. And I don't know of one being in existence. I'm going to pass it over to the net and see if anybody knows about an acoustic noise injector. It would be a little bit of a pen where the tip of the pen vibrates. It could be a piezoelectric device. It could be a piezoelectric device on the tip of a pen where inside there's some electronics that makes, let me pick a number, a 1 kilohertz note. The 1 kilohertz note goes to the piezoelectric crystal. The crystal moves because it works in both directions, the crystal. In other words, you move it, it makes voltage, or conversely, you put voltage on it and it moves. It changes dimensions. And so with that injector, now what I've done in cases like yours, Joe, is I've got a very small plastic screwdriver. It's got a plastic shaft to it. It's an insulated screwdriver, but it's got a small plastic head to it. I hold the screwdriver backwards. I hold it by the shaft, and I use the head to carefully tap on individual elements, individual components on the PC board, and usually that has done it. But in your particular case where you got something so delicate where no matter what you touch, you get this microphonic effect, and you can't tell which one it is. Yes, that little pen device. Now, as I said, I'm going to pass it over to, let me drop. I'm going to pass it over to the net to see if anybody knows of an acoustic device. If the answer is no, there's a definite need for that, Joe. You've found a need, and it's time somebody come and fill it. And that is to make something like a pen with what looks like a ordinary ballpoint pen tip to it, but that tip is not connected to an inkwell. It's connected to a piezoelectric crystal. And as the crystal receives voltage, the tip vibrates in and out, and you can touch individual components with very high accuracy because it's got a sharp point, and you can turn down the volume on this thing so you get right to the threshold of where your circuit starts acting because of the microphonic effect. And now touching individual components with just the right amount of acoustic noise would really help you in your particular troubleshooting. So putting a piezoelectric crystal on the end of a pen and home brewing it is one possible approach. It ain't going to be easy. Another approach I can think of is to take one of these super small loudspeakers, and there's lots of them being used in our radio days. Take one of those super small loudspeakers, build an audio oscillator that can be fed to it, and then make some kind of a mechanical connection between the voice coil that does the moving of the diaphragm and a pointer that comes out and touches your circuit. It'd be a little bit hokey looking, but gluing a pointer down to the cone of a very miniature loudspeaker, these ones that have got a piece of plastic as the diaphragm, that would be way of home brewing that, Joe. But there's a real need for that. And I wonder if anybody knows of an acoustic injection vent that exists on the market, that's on the shelf somewhere. If so, give me a call. That is right now. K2RAW in the ZECNAT.
C2W2B.
There's a guy with all kinds of test equipment. How have you solved that problem, John? KC2WGB, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick. It sounds silly, but what I used was an electric toothbrush. Modified the end, different length bristles, different stiffness. And because of sympathetic vibrations, I would use either modeling clay or duct seal in various locations between components to isolate them and touch. And you can actually isolate one component at a time by using that method. I've done it many times. Works well.
That's very crafty. So an electric toothbrush supplies the vibration. and you put various clays and pointers and whatever between the tip of the toothbrush and your circuit that you're testing. What I'm thinking about is they make these so-called muscle relaxer type things, vibrators. They make various vibrators for all kinds of purposes out there, and I know what you guys are thinking, but if you took one of those and put the right kind of a pointer on it and put it near your circuit. So there are vibrating things that we can get our hands on. The vibrating toothbrush sounds like the classiest one. And therefore, with the right kind of a pointer, plastic pointer between it and your component, I think that's going to help. So that, a loudspeaker with a pointer glued to the voice coil, there's various ways this can be done. The nice thing about the toothbrush is it doesn't need the acoustic circuit, the audio oscillator, so to speak. That's already there. And most of these toothbrushes these days are battery-operated, so that's a handy tool. So sitting in your bathroom is the solution to your solution and the solution to your problem, John. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, T-Q-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Let's try the comment, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
At one time, I tried using the engraving tools, but they have a tremendous amount of force and can shatter parts. You have to really be careful with that. But the clay and the duck seal was used around components around the peripheral edge so that you were disturbing one component at a time with the toothbrush and nothing else would vibrate. That helped me a lot. But there are a couple of things you can use, but I found the toothbrush with varying tips and rigidity was the best. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
You know, I think you're onto something here, John. After the beep, tell me how you use the duck seal or the modeling clay. Did you put that all around the printed circuit board so that everything is held down with a vibration damper? In other words, you're using the clay as a damper, and you're exposing one component at a time and then vibrating that component with a pointer in your toothbrush. Is that approximately how you did it, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW. Very crafty.
Yeah, Dick, you got it just about perfect. Which, as you know, you usually find a microphonic area is maybe within 4 square inches, and you may have 20, 30 parts in that area, and with new surface mounts, even more. So I would press the clay down on, say, half of it, and check one side of the board. If there was absolutely no results, then I would remove that modeling clay or the duck seal and put it on the other half of the board, and just diminishing returns and single it out. And that's exactly how it would work down. You would eventually get to where maybe you only had 3 or 4 parts that when you covered them with the clay, you wouldn't hear it at all. Well, then you know pretty much those are the parts that are causing it. And sometimes it can be two components that because of their proximity are causing the problem, which I've run into. But yeah, divide and conquer, that's the way to do it.
Boy, that's the kind of troubleshooting I've never done, John. Well done. Alrighty. I think that's part of the solution you're looking for there, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y. And by the way, when you find out what component was doing this, you've got an interesting mystery. Please come back and let us know. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, T-2-R-I-W.
Yeah, well, I was going to mention something like an engraving tool, but like what John said there, the engraving tool actually, even at the lowest setting, will destroy a part as soon as you touch it. So something of like that, where instead of having a metal tip, it would have like maybe a plastic tip, and you could turn the thing down to maybe 1/100th or 1/1000th of a power level, would be something like what I'm looking for, but I've never heard or seen or something like that ever made. That would have that kind of precision to touch part by part by part. The modeling clay idea is good, and you're right. Some of these surface mount assemblies, the parts are very, very dense. And I'm talking about something size-wise of only about maybe 1 square centimeter size-wise, that if you tap that area, you get this disturbance. You go away from the area, and the disturbance diminishes greatly as you go away from it. And by the way, this is on a device I showed you in person that day a couple months ago, and it's not the crystal.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Some of these modern-day 14-layer printed circuit boards with surface mount components, where each of the components are 0402. That means the component is 40 thou high and 20 thou wide. That's an 0402. And some of them are 0201 and so on. Tiny little components where, without using a big magnifying glass or a microscope, you almost have trouble seeing them. So you've isolated it down to a square centimeter, and with some of these extremely tiny surface mount components, in that square centimeter, in theory, you could have as many as 10 components. And to find out which one of the 10 is doing it is what you're looking for. So as I see it, there's a real need for a acoustic injection pen where it's got a volume control on the side where you can turn down the volume of the vibration coming off the tip. The tip is being vibrated by a piezoelectric crystal inside. There's a real need for that kind of a tool. Somebody's got to build it. But right now, I guess the best you can do is the automatic vibrating toothbrush. Let me drop it. An electric toothbrush. And although you can't easily turn down the volume on an electric toothbrush, although maybe some of them have got a volume control, by choosing the mechanical connection between the tip of the toothbrush that's being vibrated and your circuit, by choosing a long or a short plastic rod, a straw, or whatever, there's ways you can cut down the volume, so to speak. I mean, one way would be to somehow connect a plastic soda straw to the end of your toothbrush, and then by the way you hold the straw, you're doing some of the acoustic damping, which slows down the amount of vibration. And I guess you could plug in a pencil into the end of the straw. What did you connect, John, between your toothbrush and the tiny little component on the board that you wanted to vibrate? You put something in between the toothbrush and the component. What was that something? KC2WGB. How'd you do it? K2LIW in the tech band.
Dick, it took quite a while in testing to develop things, but what I wound up doing was very flexible springs. What I would do is stretch them out a little bit and then straighten the tip, clip it off with a pair of dykes, and then thread that spring onto this rubber knob on the toothbrush where the individual toothbrushes would go on. And I would make different tools. I made them out of plastic, made them out of spring. I also made, talk about your straw, that's another thing. I used a little air compressor and a spray nozzle from a spray can, like a tuna cleaner can. And what I did was I took a hammer and I fractured the end, the very tip of that little nozzle, which was about maybe 6 inches long, and it split into like fine hairs. And as I sprayed the compressed air, those hairs would, sort of like a duck call, they'd vibrate, and that was a very gentle way of touching components. There's so much you can do, and he'll, as he gets into it, he'll make his own tips. You can make them out of not only straws, but even different stiffness of copper wires, sometimes even like a number 20 wire, and you get it hooked up on there. It's resilient enough, it can't cause any damage, but it will transmit the vibrations, and it's all according to what you need.
SLW with a comment?
Mr. SLW, go right ahead, John, number one.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Thank you, guys. What about an in-ear headphone bud attached to something like Benny Goodman or a recording of the TechNet and hold that against the port?
Yeah, that's a possibility, an earbud. There's various ways you can make connection to an earbud, maybe even just the back of it if you don't need very gentle vibration, and make the volume going into the earbud fairly loud. That's an approach. Also, a can of cold spray. Even though his component may not be thermally sensitive, he doesn't have to freeze the component. Just the spray coming out of the end of the can really comes out of that little piece of very fine tubing as a kind of whistle. And so just the whistling of the air being held near the component could give you another clue. So earbuds, vibrating toothbrush without the toothbrush itself plugged in, just the rubber knob coming out of it that vibrates into various springs, and a soda straw and whatever. Lots of ways of doing it, but there's a real need for that component. Somebody's got to invent an acoustic vibrating pen with a volume control on the side. And so when you finally perfect this process, Joe, I think you've got a component. It's not going to make you rich, but somebody's going to really appreciate what you've done when you come out with a component that does this. W2RYY, K2RYW of the TechNet.
Well, I don't know if I'll invent it.
I don't know of that at all. I'll probably end up finding something and making something or glued something together to make it sort of do what I like it to do, or maybe just to find something by Googling something on the internet. But I thought I'd throw another tech there first, because sometimes you bring it out here, you just never know.
Yeah, in this tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, there's a lot of really crazy people, and I'm using the word crazy as a compliment. They think in a very left-handed Madison way. When they look at their wife's vibrator, and they look at that as a troubleshooting tool for their radio, and if the wife catches them doing it, boy, I would love to hear that conversation. I'd love to be a fly on the wall in that particular bedroom, if you know what I mean. Okay. All right.
A quick comment, Dick?
Go right ahead, John.
I just want to remind you, I'm sure he's aware of it, that he may try a little bit of a heat gun to see if it diminishes the noise when the parts are warmed up, because sometimes that will reveal an internal microphonic that may not be XO of the product that is vibrating. So just a reminder, KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, a heat gun, spray cold, all kinds of ways. One of the things that we rarely ever think about is that almost every printed circuit board you have ever touched, every single surface mount component you've ever touched, in reality has got a thermal coefficient of expansion. From the time you hit it with a real hot soldering iron, and the component expands while it's hot, and you tack it down to that printed circuit board, and while the solder is still pretty hot, the solder goes from the liquid state to the solid state, and now that component is held down to that board like all, it would take the hammers of hell to remove it, so to speak, and then the component is going to cool off, and at some other rate, the printed circuit board is going to cool off, and the amount of mechanical stress that can exist between that tiny component and that printed circuit board, I'll bet you the times when there was 500 pounds of mechanical stress between that component and that printed circuit board because of the differences in thermal expansion and the fact that the one is anchored to the other, and one temperature of one portion is at a different height. Guarantee with rare exception, you're almost never going to find a printed circuit board that has the exact same rate of thermal expansion as your component. It ain't going to be that matched. So therefore, as it cools, or on a cold day versus a hot day, all of these components are being mechanically stressed on that board. We all forget about that. And if you start thinking about it, it'll give you nightmares. I'm amazed that some of these things can take it, if you know what I mean, that we don't get a lot more failures. So as you finally found out what component in that very fancy circuit of yours that you brought over to my house, as I remember, it was approximately a UHF frequency synthesizer, a very well-made commercial, I think it was Motorola brand, frequency synthesizer, very compact with a 14-layer board and a whole bunch of tiny surface mount components you have to look at with a repeater. Time out. As I said, it was a circuit you have to look at with a microscope. When you finally find out what it is, Joe, I was suspicious of the crystal. You were fairly sure it wasn't, and we'll soon find out what it was. So when you do find out, please come back and let us know. Another one of those great mysteries. Joe number two is up next. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Joe number two, K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, I want to just make one more comment, because you just said something at the end of your last transmission about the thermal expansion, and that just, and I just, and the idea just popped in my head about why these problems are occurring. Can I just say something?
You got the floor, Joe. Go right ahead.
These devices are all used on 800 megahertz, and they're basically completely self-contained oscillating units, oscillators and synthesizers, because that crystal doesn't determine the frequency of the device itself. That is a reference oscillator within itself. But with what you said about the thermal expansion and contraction of different parts and the circuit board, say if that was true, could it take a rather high short G-shock to actually fracture a part or fracturing a part off the board if it was the shock was severe enough, if knowing that these parts had that kind of pressure exerted on them internally between the time they heat up, the time they cool down from, you know, surface mount, wave soldering, or they really put these things together. You think that's a good possibility?
Absolutely. If we did a thorough enough fault analysis, analysis of printed circuit boards like the one you've got, Joe, I think you would find out that when the board was hot, for all we know, it would take a 50G shock and nothing would happen. When the board is cold, and now because of the difference in thermal expansion where your component is being really physically stressed, and now you give it a 50G shock, you're going to get a crack, a microscopic crack inside the component that you could only see with an extremely high gain microscope or an electrical measurement. So would a printed circuit board be more thermally shock susceptible, whether it's hot or cold or depending on how it was built? Absolutely. And if we did a thorough enough probe analysis, I think we would discover that. But as I said, once I know what kind of thermal expansion takes place, once you watch the actual soldering process, as I've done 1,000 times in the last couple of years, where I was using a stereo zoom microscope, where I was using fiber optic lighting coming from the sides, where I'm looking at a technicolor stereo picture with both eyes, with high resolution and with good contrast and good good color resolution. When I'm looking at microscopic components under that microscope while I'm soldering the components, and I'm watching what's going on, I'm watching the solder crawl, and you can easily see, let me drop it. With a microscope under those conditions, you can see the surface reflectivity, the optical reflectivity of the surface of the solder make a very characteristic change as the solder goes from the liquid state to the plastic state to the solid state. It goes directly from liquid state to solid state if it was eutectic solder, 6337 solder, tin lead content. But anything but eutectic solder goes from liquid state to sort of a plastic state and then a solid state. And you can watch those states take place by the change in the sheen of the surface of the solder when you're looking at it with high enough magnification, with the right kind of microscope, stereo zoom microscope, with the right kind of fiber optic lighting. Under those conditions, you'll see things on a printed circuit board that you would always miss when it comes to tiny little whiskers, when it comes to tiny little solder balls that you would never know are there. You'd be amazed how dirty the real world is when you've got enough magnification to look at these tiny, tiny surface mount components while you're working on them. Over to you, Joe. WA2RYY, K2RYW, Matechnet.
Very good, Dick. That's a fascinating observation. Okay, back to TechNet, and you can go forward to the next guy on the list there. Thanks for the input, WA2RYY.
USOW, one more comment, please.
Yeah, go ahead, John. Wait for the beeps, and you got it, John. John, number one.
I'm not familiar with where he's using the board, but he should keep in mind that the board itself is subject to acoustic, if the board itself is subject to acoustic vibration while the board is in service, that might be causing his problem too.
Oh, John, number one, you hit the nail on the head. As Joe described it to me, this board is mounted inside of a handy talkie, for an 800 megacycle handy talkie. I think it's a Motorola brand, but I'm not sure. But anyhow, it is a very well-designed commercial frequency synthesizer sub-assembly of this handy-talkie. And when he gets a failure of them, where they become microphonic, the vibration from the loudspeaker shakes the printed circuit board. The printed circuit board goes into its intermittent mode, and you get a feedback where the whole darn radio goes into a squeal because of the acoustic vibration caused by the the loudspeaker in the handy-talkie shaking the board, causing the problem. That's how he first discovered it. That combined with knocking on it with your fist and tapping it on the table, he isolated it down to this printed circuit board. When he replaces the printed circuit board, the problem goes away. But the printed circuit board is a very expensive assembly, and he, being a typical ham radio operator who wants to know what failed and can I fix it, he's got a whole pile of these defective printed circuit boards, and if he was able to make them start working, he's going to be a hero. And for all he knows, there's a common denominator in the way they fail, and that's part of the analysis he's doing. The manufacturer doesn't want to do the analysis. They just want to sell you another assembly at $180, if you know what I mean. And for all we know, it's a 30-cent component inside that board of this $180 assembly that's creating the problem. Am I somewhat close to a target on this one, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Oh, yeah. I think you definitely nailed it right on the head. Good.
Okay. So the mystery continues. And keep up the good work, Joe. We amateurs are, at times, very good at troubleshooting. Who would ever think that the...
Repeater, time out.
As I was starting to say, who would ever think that the toothbrush in your bathroom is an analysis tool for troubleshooting a frequency synthesizer inside of a very elaborate modern-day handy-talkie, commercial handy-talkie. Who would ever think it? Only the hands. They're very crafty people. Joe number two, KC2, QIW. Go right ahead, Joe. K2RIW in the tech man. KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Are you there, Joe? K2RIW? Okay, maybe we'll have to come back to Joe.
Okay.
Wes, I called you earlier, and you didn't seem to be there.
Sorry. I was late.
Already? Into XJN. I know you're pursuing multiple subjects simultaneously, Wes. Just choose one of them, and let's discuss it. Into XJN, K2RIW.
I would like to find out if Glenn is there. And because I don't want to take too much time, I have sent you the last video that was only a very short video with the explosion. And it was pretty spectacular. So if Glenn is there, we're going to discuss it now. If not, then we can take the time after poll and discuss it. Is Glenn there?
Yeah, I'm not here on KC2QIW. I did view the audio, the video you described, Wes. And for those who are not listening, you want to know what audio it is, I'm pretty sure that Wes sent it on to Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar. You can always go to his website and see the exact thing that we're talking about. And that's Bernie@huntfamily.org, I think it is, or huntfamily.com, I think it is. You go to that particular website, and you'll find the exact URL of this particular video. The video is a video of something that I'm going to call a miniaturized Tesla coil. In other words, this coil of wire with a metal plate on the top, and the metal plate looks like it's about 3 or 4 inches in diameter. The guy is holding on to something like, I think it's a metal rod, in his hand. He touches the top of this metal plate. He's able to draw an arc of, I'm going to pick a number, quarter of an inch or so. He can draw an arc. Because it's operating at a relatively high frequency, and because of the so-called skin effect, what happens, let me drop. What happens with a Tesla coil is that the actual frequency of oscillation of the Tesla coil is 100 kc, half a megacycle, 2 megacycles, at some relatively high frequency where the skin effect takes over. Therefore, the current that flows into the human being when you touch a Tesla coil or any other kind of a high-frequency circuit, all of that current flows on the skin of the human being, doesn't penetrate, therefore you don't feel it, and you can draw an arc. So this guy, by the skin effect, is drawing the arc, holding onto this metal rod, touching the top of this thing that I'm going to call a miniature Tesla coil. Not quite sure what it was. And so everything's hunky-dory. Then he picks up this great big toroidal-shaped object, which looks like a great big... It looks like a great big magnet. I'm not sure what it was, but this large metallic object, it's smaller in diameter than the metal plate on the top of his Tesla coil. He picks up this metal thing, and I'm pretty sure the Tesla coil was turned off at the time. He deposits this metal object, this toroidal-shaped metal object, on top of the metal plate of this miniature Tesla coil, and then he turns the Tesla coil back on. He takes his metal rod, brings it over to the top of this metal object, and he hears the loudest arc in the world. It's like an explosion, and he goes hollering because of the current flowing through him. And so I think Wes is asking, why in the world was that difference just because we added that extra metallic object on the top of his miniature thing that I'm going to call a Tesla coil? And by the way, it's a Russian website that did this, and Wes, I think, speaks the language. Therefore, you probably are going to do the translation as to what these guys were saying. Maybe we'll get a further explanation. N2XJN, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Yes, I do. I speak Russian very well, although I have never been to Russia. With a Moscow accent. I had a pretty interesting explanation from Glenn, and Glenn was kind of wow on it. And he asked me, did I send that video to you and to Bernie? Of course I did. And the main question was, how is that possible? So I don't want to talk for him. If he's there, he'll be able to pick up. I wonder if you have an answer, because the distance between the electrode, which was the piece of metal, which was the welding electrode that he held, was about 5 inches from the top. Now, what you have is on the top of the spool sort of Tesla coil, you have a flat disc. The flat disc is made, I think, from lead. And then there's no hole on it. So you can touch the electrode into it, and you see there's more spark. And, of course, your fingers. Glenn had a different idea of what was the voltage. He said it was pretty low. Well, I said that it was about 5,000 volts. But anyhow, now we have another element, which is the skin effect. But in a word, 5 inches in the air over the flat disk, you have a rapid explosion from the metal electrode that was put close to the magnet that was lying flat on that disk and touch it.
I've got a couple of guesses as to what's going on here, Wes. First of all, when the thing is operating without the metal toroidal-shaped object on top, that disk that looks like it's about 3 or 4 inches in diameter on the top of his thing, I'm going to call a miniature Tesla coil, and it's an unusual Tesla coil because usually the secondary winding of a Tesla coil is made of a few thousand turns of 30-gauge wire on a great big long tube. That's the usual way of building a Tesla coil. This thing has the secondary winding of a Tesla coil, looks like about 4 turns of a very large copper rod type thing. And so that made it unusual. But the fact that at first, when he's holding onto the welding rod in his hand and he brings it near the top of the plate and he draws an arc of about 1/4 inch, and air has a dielectric strength of around 30,000 volts per centimeter. If there was 30,000 volts there, he could draw an arc of 1 centimeter. And he drew an arc of something like 1/4 centimeter, so maybe 0.5 centimeter. I think it's 1/4 centimeter. So there's a few thousand volts. Now, when he adds that metallic object to the top plate of his Tesla coil, 2 or 3 things are happening simultaneously. One, the total amount of capacitance of the end is changing. The possibility exists, let me drop. The possibility exists when he added that extra piece of metal that he changed the resonant frequency of the secondary winding of his Tesla coil and brought it closer to resonance. Therefore, the total amount of voltage there, once it went into resonance, could be hugely larger. That's change number one. Change number two, because now he's got a much larger metallic object on top, he now has a much larger capacitance. So not only is he getting a greater voltage because it got closer to resonance, or exactly on resonance, the voltage got larger, the magnitude of the capacitance got larger, therefore the total amount of stored energy in the top of the Tesla coil got a lot larger. However, for it to be so darn much that he now drew this great big arc, made that very loud bang, and it suddenly almost electrocuted the guy, and he started screaming. What really happened there is still a bit of a mystery. And so it ain't clear to me. I mean, the skin effect should still be there. If it's an RF circuit, you don't suddenly lose the skin effect, and therefore, even though the current may be